that may or may not be true and start class this morning. If you all would indulge us for a moment, let's begin our class in a prayer. Holy God, we acknowledge you today as our master. We acknowledge you as the creator. We acknowledge you as the author of life. We know that you're a God of love and that your love for us is constant and enduring. We know also, Father, that as humans, we can be mercurial. We can be changeable. We can be malleable. Circumstances can take us off the right path. We get distracted by worldly matters, and we sometimes take our eyes off spiritual matters. I'd ask, dear God, that you forgive us when we stray from your path. That you help us this morning as students and teachers here at Glenpool and Christians who are meeting in your name around the world. Help us to focus on your word. Help us to focus on the life and example of Jesus. Help us to learn. Help us to grow. Help us to become more like Jesus. Give us the courage to witness to others. Give us the boldness to invite people from our communities into our church, that they might also hear the good news, understand your love, and come to have a relationship with you in the way that we have. We ask you to bless us all, those here in the building and those participating remotely. In the name of Jesus, amen. Well, good morning, everybody. It is, we're on the second to last lesson, and my temptation was to treat these last two lessons as the smorgasbord of things that I've thought of or examples that I've been given by many of you, which I'm thankful for, more experienced teachers who've given me some ideas on where I could have gone or what I should have done. But instead, I'm going to kind of stick to my original plan, and I think that we'll, I've got some augmentations here and there. But what I'd like to talk about today, in today's lesson, is raising the bar a little bit. When you have a mentor, and I know from our previous lessons, many of you have had mentors in your professional life and some of you in your spiritual life as well, your mentor has expectations of you. And if your mentors are like mine, their expectations were just a little past where you were. I never did have a decent mentor come up to me and say, "You're finished, Devin. You're as good as you're ever going to get. you've arrived. Congratulations. Have a great day." And the reason that didn't happen is not because I'm not perfect, even though I am definitely not perfect. A mentor never operates that way. That's just not how it works. A mentor looks at us, looks with love in the way that Jesus looked at his followers and said, there's some more work for us to do. There's a little bit further to go. There's an opportunity for a deeper understanding. The fields are ripe unto harvest. I could go on and on and on, but we'll get into the lesson here and talk about that. So let me get started in 2 Timothy. And I'm going to read 2 Timothy 1, 5 through 7. "I am reminded of your sincere faith, a faith that dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and now I am sure dwells in you. Hence I remind you to rekindle the gift of God that is within you through the laying on of my hands. For God did not give us a spirit of timidity, but a spirit of power and of love and of self-control." So here we see Paul encourage is not quite right for this. This is more of exhort. What's the difference between encouragement and exhortation? Anybody? I'm splitting hairs here, aren't I? That's a big vocabulary lesson for early in the morning. Encouragement lets somebody know, hey, you're on the right track, good work. Exhortation, you're encouraging them to further works. You're moving the goalpost just a little bit. You're raising the bar, so to speak. And I want us to examine some of these passages today where we see a bar being raised. I think how we communicate expectations is so important as mentors, as teachers. Did anybody long jump in here? Do we have any long jumpers? A few? I don't really have the body shape for long jumping, but I was a long jumper, surprisingly. I was extraordinarily mediocre. I was the third heat character in most track meets, but I won a lot of races in the third heat. When you win, even if it's in the third heat, it's really fun to win something. But I was very rarely on the winner's circle at the end of the meet. We had a rhythm in high school track, in Muskogee at least. We would jump three times, and then after you were done jumping, you took turns holding the rake. We jumped into a sand pit. And our sand pit was full of that nut sedge grass, that terrible, terrible, what do you all call that around here? Witch grass? I've heard it called something else in Oklahoma. But you know that terrible, terrible stringy grass. And so we would rake the sand and we would be pulling that stuff out. But we would always set the rake down as the marker for that next person. And you know, even as children, and I mean 15, 16, 17-year-old kids, we never set that rake where you jumped last time. Not one time. We never set it close in. We always set it just a little beyond where you jumped. Somehow, instinctively, and I'm telling you now, no one ever taught me this. And I suspect no one ever taught the kids who showed me. I think that this is just the way it's done. The way it's done. You jumped, and I'm old, so 19 feet was considered a wonderful jump in my day. I think there are frogs that can jump 19 feet, but we thought we were doing good if we got near 20. It doesn't matter what you jumped. We would set that rake handle next to the sand pit, just a little beyond, just about a foot beyond, 8 inches beyond, 6 inches beyond, because we knew that's what we were jumping for. We didn't have flags. We didn't have markers. Our practice pit was not denoted with markings of any kind that I knew about. But that's just how the kids did it. They put it just a little past where we were. And I think mentors, I think Christians, that's what I see in these scriptures, and that's what I see in Timothy. I am reminded of your sincere faith that dwells first in your grandmother. God did not give us a spirit of timidity, but a spirit of power and love and self-control. That's moving the bar a little. That's, in my story, the rake. The rake just doesn't sound quite as good as the bar. You see where I'm going. So people will rise to expectations. Some of you have been teachers. You know what I'm talking about. One of the keys to success as a mentor is seeing wonderful possibilities. We talked about this in lesson two. I think the phraseology was mentors have vision. And I don't mean mentors are trying to create people who are just like themselves. I don't mean that at all. And I don't think Paul was trying to make Timothy into a new Paul. But I do think, I know from reading this, that Paul saw some things in Timothy. He saw some incredible potential. He saw a pathway for his protege, Daryl, I'm going to use it proud, that went to a different location. The trajectory was different than Paul's journey. And he encouraged Timothy forward. And he set a higher bar. Not higher than what Paul achieved. That would have been a tough, being mentored by somebody like that would be a harrowing experience. But beyond where Timothy had been. Does that make any sense? And that, guys, as we look at the younger Christians in our church, our young families, our teens, our children, that's our calling, is to exhort them beyond encouragement to go a little further, do a little more, be a little bit more Christ-like, read the Bible, study, get a deeper understanding, see who really needs help, see what help they really need. One of the things, the challenges of ministry, that if I could write myself a letter, my younger Christian self, the true need is not what people often ask at first. And it took me decades of working with people and trying to help them to realize there's the perceived need that the individual voices, and then there's a true need. And the two don't always line up in ministry. And I think it's perfectly acceptable for us, when we're mentoring our young members, our brothers and our sisters, to expect them to dig a little deeper, to try to find out what's happening. When a member has a little trouble and needs benevolence, as an elder, we always try to ask just a few more questions. We've had members of our little community here at Glenpool who've been unemployed more than a year in the last couple of years. And you sat next to them, and you might never have known. They suffered quietly. They got helped quietly. But if somebody didn't make a few inquiries as to exactly what's happening, it wouldn't have been known. And I'm not here to talk about the human pride and our unwillingness to ask for help or any of those things. What I want to talk to you guys about is sometimes that can only be covered by just a second pass, a little more. And seekers, people in our community who get involved looking for God, as David said so eloquently in a recent class, are you looking for God because it's an emergency? Are you seeking after the Lord because everything has blown up? Or do you have that kind of sincere prayer life and relationship with God the rest of the time? When he said that, I'll tell you, I remember that, and I've been thinking about it an awful lot, because some of my most sincere prayers are when things have been difficult. But that's our opportunity with people. If they're reaching out for X, we need to ask about Y. If a brother asks you to walk 1 mile with them, walk 2. If they ask for your shirt, you probably should give them your cloak as well, or coat, as the translation may be. So I want us to really think about how we're talking to these people when we're mentoring them. Telling somebody you expect a lot is super important, and it's more important than I've realized until I started this lesson. And I'm going to give some examples of communicating with somebody in a way that says you expect a lot. You would make a fine deacon. What's that communicating to somebody? Anybody? You can. I'm going to put you to work. Is what that's, just so you know. When someone says that to you, you're about to get put to work. And by the way, that's probably their job, to put you to work. I want you to be receptive to those conversations when they happen. But the group in here, we're the people who are initiating that side of the conversation. And so don't ever be ashamed about that. Many of you wouldn't ask somebody for help if you needed it, but I hope all of you would ask for help for the church when the church needs it. Can I say it that way? I'll just leave that there. Let me give you another quote. Oh, my thing stopped. I know that you'll be great parents. What's bundled up in that? Who would you say, I know you'll be great parents to? somebody who's already a perfect parent? Wouldn't make any sense. You'd say you're great parents. There are a couple of families in here whose kids are ordered like a platoon on drill review. You know, the day at the, near the end of boot, when the general comes to review everybody and everything is Bristol fashion, ship-shaped, clean, scrubbed, pressed, starched. There are families who march in here with their kids, and I didn't know a bunch of kids that entered the room. I wouldn't tell them, I know that you'll be great parents. Who I might tell, I know you'll be great parents, is somebody whose kids come in here with one shoe missing, brother's hitting sister. Sister might have pulled brother's hair earlier. We don't know what happened. I know you'll be great parents is a way to say, I see you're trying. I'm encouraging you. I get this. Don't panic. Because you remember how it was trying to herd children. Sometimes you feel like you're trying to get five goats into the auditorium with the noise and the commotion. Or another quote, I see a lot of myself in you. Now, this wouldn't work for me because that would scare somebody. I hope not, Devin. I hope you don't see that. But many of you are respectable members of our community and our church. And a comment like that lets somebody know, you can get where I'm at. You can achieve what I've achieved. If you have 80 years, 90 years, and you tell somebody, I see a lot of myself in you, that's about the best compliment you could give them. If you're at church, and I know it can seem prideful, and you people are as humble as any group I've ever been in a room with, but I promise you, that sort of exhortation would really make an impression on somebody. And it might make an impression on them long after you're gone. Because I've had Christians, men and women both, exhort me and encourage me, and I remember their names, and I remember those, and I'm going to use the word charges. Because when you encourage somebody, it's an attaboy. When you give somebody an exhortation to move forward, you're giving them a charge. You're putting something by their name that says, I expect this. I see that you're on a path. I want you to continue. Some of those people who've encouraged me have gone on to their reward. Their exhortation means nothing less to me knowing that they're gone. In fact, I feel as though there might be some remnant of them left in my behavior, in my Christian walk, in my attitude. Okay, conversely, if we communicate negative messages, it will make success harder or impossible. And I got a little too far into computer science last week, and I apologize about some of the inner ring talk and trusted interrupts. This is as far as I'm going into IT today. This message, epic fail, you fail, 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 no cancel, no red X, that is just, it's all over for you, right? That's, when your computer does this, and I hope your computer doesn't, it's all frustration. This is what you see before you walk away from the computer and quit interacting for a while. Maybe forever, or if you're like my father, you might box that thing up and put it in the dumpster at a time like this. But we want to be very careful that we don't send out that kind of message. We've already had a lesson on rebuke and correction, and my advice on that was that we bookend that with love on both sides. So today I just want to talk about some negative messaging and how that might hold people back. And so we're going to contrast these to what we talked about a minute ago. Quote, I knew you would not work out here. What's that say to somebody? What's the message? You want them gone. You don't belong. You don't belong. And by the way, I predisposed that you shouldn't be here somehow, through some means. I can see that you won't discipline your child. What's that saying? You're a bad parent. The won't is the key in this one. I'll be honest with you, I've had to say something a lot like, I can see that you're not disciplining your child a time or two. But when you say won't, that's a superlative. That's in the future, you won't be able to master this. And that's the wrong communication, in my opinion. That sends the wrong message. I don't understand people like you. What's the message in that? People like you are different than people like me, right? We're not the same. That's the contrast, too. I can see a lot of myself in you. I don't understand people like you is I'm giving up on our relationship. You can't get where I'm gone. You'll never have the accolades that I have. You'll never serve God for 40 years faithfully the way I have. That's all wrapped up in a message like that. And so we don't want to give those messages to anybody, but we especially don't want to give them when we're mentoring. Let me get into Philippians. And I'm going to read from Philippians 4, verses 12 and 13. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. In any and all circumstances, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and want. I can do all things in Him who strengthens me. So, this is not a message to somebody else. This is a story about a personal experience. Why do you think this sort of thing is important in mentoring? Any idea? When people tell a little bit about their own experience, what does that do? When people admit they've made mistakes, and in this case, there's three different references in here to hard times, right? Abased, want, hunger. Okay? Something went wrong there. And by the way, you can be hungry and not have made any mistakes. But as well as this person has endured seasons of plenty and abundance. I don't know quite how to say this, but I think in America today, affluence is as dangerous to Christians as want is. I think sometimes we lose members to a complete lack of dependence on anything. The pandemic has been wonderful in a lot of ways because you could get everything you need delivered to your house. But I had huge problems with that because someone had to go deliver those groceries. I went out and I did switch grocery stores. I'll be perfectly honest with you. And I switched the way I shopped. I started going to an actual butcher during the pandemic. I wouldn't have some teenager come to my house and deliver food. Now, I might. You put another 20 years on my odometer? Okay, bring the food on out, young man. That sounds great. But in my case, I did my own shopping. But the fact that we can do that and not see another human for weeks and months, I'm not so sure. That was great for not spreading a virus that we could communicate one with another. I get that. But this is not how humanity works. We're social. We're tribal. And we get together. And so the story about what I've been through, and anybody listening here in this room, you part of your story is now I went through the pandemic. We survived the pandemic. We lost people. In my family, we've lost several. As survivors, as the people who didn't move on, we have an obligation to tell that story. And we have an obligation to future generations to explain something to them about how it happened. What we did right, what we did wrong, what we learned. Do you guys have a trophy case like this back at your high school? Anybody? If your high school's still standing, by the way. Yes? No? Well, that's yes, I hear you. One comment is I haven't been there in a long time. But you remember the trophy case, right? That was in the, maybe it was in the first T intersection past the administrative building. Bobby, you probably went to a one-room schoolhouse. I'm so sorry that you didn't have anything like that. I pick on Bobby because he's close. But do you ever get your name or your team's name in that trophy case? I suspect some of your names are engraved somewhere even now. Did that change your life? For a few weeks, for a month? Your coach might have talked to you about playing whatever it was at the college level. Probably hasn't changed your life completely. But you know, I think trophies tell the younger folks who come along, I did something. I did this. So can you. My name's not on anything anywhere, but I think there are a couple banners hanging in a few gyms here and there that I was part of. And when that banner is up there and it says whatever, whatever, 1980 something, I'd never thought what that banner was for. At the time, I thought, well, they're celebrating what we did, right? I don't think that's why the banner's there. I really don't. With a little wisdom, that banner's there for the little kids, for the next generation, for the generation after that. It says something happened. We did a thing. I expect you to do something. I expect this trophy case to not have the trophies in it from 1972 anymore. Can we get them out? How do we get them out? Anybody? Run out of room? Because we had new trophies come in. That's how it's supposed to work. And we're so close to Tulsa. I've been in every gym in Tulsa. And I say that, probably haven't been in every one, but I sure feel like I have, following Eli and Vivian around with basketball. And the saddest situation is when I see a trophy case full of stuff. And some of them are amazing achievements. But some of them have the end in the 1950s, in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s. And as a young person, I would have looked at those and thought, wow, what an amazing achievement that stood this whole time. But now I look at that and think, oh, we got to clear these out of here. Where are the trophies from the 90s? Where are the trophies from the 2000s? Where are the trophies from the 20-teens? Where's the trophies from 2020? And so I want us to tell our stories. I want us, like in Philippians, to freely recount that we've had hardships and we've had triumphs. But the common thread in all that, if we go back to Philippians, is that I can do all things through him who strengthens me. That's what matters. Oh, did somebody back up for me? You guys are great. Unless I did that. That's what matters. That's what's relevant. So, let's talk about how the richness of your experience can bless somebody. The younger members of our church will go through many of the same struggles you have. I mean the same struggles. Sin has not changed. God has not changed. Mankind has not changed our fundamental nature. We can now sin with email, and we can get in. Instead of going to the shady, what's it called, the bad part of town, the red light district, instead of going to the red light district in town, we can go to the red light district on the internet now. But it's still sin. Hasn't changed a bit. Kids can send inappropriate messages on TikTok. Is that the current one? TikTok, I think, is current. Probably anymore. But we could send inappropriate messages by writing them on the stall of the men's room. And people of our generations did. Technically, I think it lasts longer than a tweet if you write it with a good Sharpie. So we've got to pass on our stories. we need to make the younger generation understand we had triumphs, we had trouble, we had great days. Telling your story can let the young Christians know that they belong. When you tell somebody your story, you're adding a chapter to that story. We are a tribal people. Psychologists suggest that humans get things done most readily in groups between 5 and 11 people. My second or third boss was, his theory was management through food. He always said you need to break bread with somebody. If you have to tell them good news or bad news, you need to feed them. And you need to be eating when you do it. And I think that goes back to our tribal nature. If we tell people how God was faithful to you through adversity, it's critical. Why is that critical for them to hear? To see where we've been, because what are they going to face? Trials. My grandparents talked to us about the Great Depression. My grandparents were obsessed with the Great Depression, and I don't say that lightly. My grandparents kept way more food in the house than you would need, because they went through a time when you couldn't get food if you wanted it. I grew up in a place where the pantry was bigger than the kitchen. And this idea of I need to go to the store to cook a meal, my grandmother would have been insulted at the thought. My grandmother went to the store to cook meals next week. She planned everything in advance. Just-in-time inventory did not happen. Kanban, if for those of you who are business nerds, this did not happen in my grandmother's kitchen. And I got a series of lessons, as well as all of her children and grandchildren, to get ready for another Great Depression. And it did not occur. We had a pandemic instead. on my watch. When I was running a larder, when I was the one doing the shopping, it was a pandemic. But I will tell you, I drew upon my grandmother's lessons. I drew upon her courage. And I drew upon the fact that she made it through that. I knew that she'd come out the other side. And that she'd kept her family intact and her children fed somehow. A story where you made moral progress can enable the growth of the listener. Maybe not right then. Have you taken writing classes? Do you know what I mean when I say moral progress? There's a theory on literature that it's not a good story unless the protagonist makes moral progress. Humans, we identify with stories where the protagonist learns a lesson, where they grow, where they move forward. Telling people stories where we faced adversity and triumph, or where we were wrong and we got right, where we made mistakes and God gave us the grace and the opportunity to repent and to rectify. That's building a road for everybody who follows us. It's enabling them to say, I can do this. Just because I might have made a mistake, I don't think I'm in good battery shape. I've got a red light.
that's appropriate. I like that idea.
I think it's fine for a trophy to lose its worldly value over time. Whoever won this trophy probably polished it. I'm guessing it was important to them. But the trophies outlived them, and nobody polished it anymore. However, this has one real value. It's proof that somebody did something good. And I want you to look at your own stories like a trophy. And I want you to pass them on. If you can discuss your seasons of abundance and your seasons of deprivation, if you can share this with younger members, it will get them ready for hard times. And I can tell you firsthand it will. A trophy shouldn't make those who come along feel lesser. It should make them feel that they can do great things too. Somebody did this. I expect something from you. We need to make sure this comes across when we're mentoring young Christians. We need to make sure that there's a pathway to the future in the church. Philippians 1, 6 through 8. And I am sure that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. It is right for me to feel thus about you because I hold you in my heart. For you are all partakers with me of grace, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel. For God is my witness, and I yearn for you all with the affection of Christ Jesus. I'm not sure that there's any better passage than verse 6 if you're going to exhort somebody to further works, if you're going to exhort somebody to continue on. And there's no need to wait until you're in prison to send a message like that. There's no need to wait until I'm in an ICU bed to tell somebody that I know for a fact that God will be faithful to them. He who began a good work in you. What is the implication of this? What's began? It's the start of the race. What's the hidden implication when you talk about somebody else at the beginning of a race? Where are you in this story? You might be near the end. Or you might, like some of us, be able to see that your race has an end. As I've told you before, I was not sure I was mortal at 17. At 20, I wasn't sure I could be killed by car wrecks or bullets. I just wasn't. At 45, I realized I could be killed by a piece of stray food that goes down the wrong pipe. At my present age, there are a lot of things that could kill me. My doctor has a small list. And he sounds like an actuary when I talk to him, in fact, more than a doctor. Here's the things that could kill you. And so I know for a fact that my race has an end. And I know for a fact that I need to prep the runners who are going to continue forward. I know for a fact that if the Lord tarries, the church will need ministers, servants, deacons, workers, everything. I am sure that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion. I don't know if there's a more beautiful thing for a Christian to say to another Christian. I really don't. I think that that is so full of love and expectation. That's a charge. That's what I meant earlier by charge. This is a charge. I expect from you. I have expectations. And it's right for me to feel thus about you because I hold you in my heart. You don't waste time exhorting somebody you don't care about. If you love people, you expect things from them. If you love younger people, you want them to do everything you did right. And you want them to avoid doing everything you did wrong. And by the way, the second one's possibly impossible, but I love that you want that. So we need to equip them for when mistakes do happen. Who will do our work when we move on? Exhorting someone to grow in Christ is a pure ministry. Over the years, a lot of companies I work with have something called career and succession planning. And this is more popular in Europe than it is in the United States. But some of the largest corporations in the U.S. are pretty tied into that. This is a largely fictional idea, but I think it's fascinating to go into. The idea in career and succession planning is that I know what job I'll get promoted into in 5 years. I know where my career path is, my trajectory, based on my education and interests and surveys and yada, yada, yada. I know where I'm going to appear in the company in the future. Consequently, I need to be backfilled. So the people who work for me, I know which of them is going to take over for me. And that's a conversation that gets had in a tentative way with those people. In Germany, this is a real thing. And people get groomed based on what they think you're going to do in 5 years. Now, in America, we have trouble with this. And I am such an amazing American, I have a lot of trouble with this. Wait a minute. How would I know where I'm going to be in 5 years? Hold on. I'm not interested in somebody determining my career destiny for me. I resist. I'm too much of a rebel. However, the concept is fascinating, even when it doesn't work out. When you groom somebody for a promotion and they don't get that promotion that you've groomed them for, your grooming is not wasted. It's not wasted in any way. If we get somebody here in church ready to be the deacon of grounds and how to prepare their budget and how to organize everything and make everything ship shape in our garage, and that deacon ends up the deacon of IT, there was nothing wasted. There was nothing wasted at all. The parts change. I'm not keeping spare mower blades anymore or belts or fuel. I'm keeping network cables and a monitor in the back. So I want us to think about this sort of succession, this sort of replacement, because we need workers, servants, ministers, leaders, and teachers. And if the Lord tarries, we may need them for a long time. Paul, looking forward, I don't think Paul knew how far he was looking forward. But his preparations have lasted 1,900 years. And we're just a link in that chain today. If that makes any sense. Comments? I'm done on time for the first time in a couple lessons. So anything to add or take away? Mr. Bobby.
I always told the kids, you know what, you've got on track team, you've got some good ones, you've got some that aren't so good, and you've got some that bless their heart. Every time we had a meet, I got the kids together, and I told them, I want you to know from my standpoint, whether you finish first, second, or 25th, if you're running hard at the end of the race, there's going to be one person there to tell you did a good job. And I think that's what instilled these kids to want to do good. And the second one is, being around sports all my life, I've talked to so many kids who are athletes and tell them you may not even understand your ministry of mentoring that some guys are looking at you.
Yep.
You can start the mentoring process way before maybe you can consider it.
No, and I think many of us have been an example to people before we had any awareness that we were an example. I can think of a kid I went to school with. I never heard him say a bad word in a locker room. His last name's Coburn, his first name's Chris. I'm just going to tell the internet he was a good kid. Never heard him cuss. And we had some trouble. We had some struggles. And that kid made an impression on me. And those kids who used a little bit of froward language Couldn't tell you their names now, but I remember that kid who wouldn't say a bad word about anyone or anything to this day. And he was my age mentoring. So anyway, thank you all so much. Love you guys. I'm back next week, and then after that is Mr. Lyerly in here. Thank you all.